Welcome to episode 17 of All the Small Takes on this Monday night, and I'm here with Cooper and John, and this is actually an intervention for Cooper. We just want to surround you, buddy, with people who can tell you that they love you, can tell you that they care about you. We know it's been a rough past 4 days. We just want to make sure you're holding up okay. Us and the listeners, give you some emotional support. How are you hanging in there?
I'm doing well. I keep on holding on to the fact that my life would be very different if I wouldn't have managed my expectations last week.
I still believe.
I don't. No belief.
Did you ever believe?
No.
Off to a really optimistic start so far.
Yeah, this is the apostasy edition of All the Small Things.
Yeah, so we're going to try to lift Cooper's spirits. I have a different opinion than Cooper. And we're going to talk about the NBA Finals. We're going to talk some U.S. soccer. We're also going to roll out a brand new segment. Excited about that. We think you guys will be excited about too. So we're going to jump into all that. But first, we want to tell you quickly that you can find us on any social media. Takes, Instagram, small_takes. Facebook, All the Small Takes, and Gmail, allthesmalltakes@gmail.com. Subscribe on iTunes and leave us a review. The offer still stands, 15 reviews. Cooper cries, which you might get on this podcast anyway. So maybe not that appealing anymore, but Cooper will cry for 15 reviews and John will make the deer mating sound for 15 reviews.
Yep.
Right?
Definitely.
I mean, it's a verbal contract, right, John?
I'm not a lawyer. I wouldn't know.
I think that's a yes. All right. So the NBA Finals, Cooper. You obviously watched games 1 and 2. You were very vocal in the group chat about your displeasure with primarily the officiating, but also LeBron James. And really, I guess first your thoughts on the first 2 games and what went wrong for the Cavs.
Sure. So I think like any fan, you know, my first instinct is to always blame it on the officials. Yeah, so I mean, that's my first gripe. I think game 2 specifically was frustrating to watch, especially the way in which LeBron was driving to the rim. He only shot 5 free throws. Steph shot, I don't know, like 14, even though he had less field goal attempts. I do think the NBA has created sort of a problem where fouls on the perimeter are definitely I would say contact on the perimeter is definitely not officiated the same way or even close, like remotely to how contact in the post is officiated. But I think that's a whole nother conversation for another day. I am very frustrated with LeBron. I've read lots of articles today, lots of tweets and whatever about how LeBron played out of his mind in game 2. He had a triple-double, led the team in all 3 major categories, rebounding, assists, and scoring. But I was really disappointed with LeBron's game 2 performance. I don't know how he went from completely dominating the first half, dominating the lane, driving to the hoop, putting up layup after layup. I saw him attempt, I think, 1 layup in the entire second half. And that's, we need LeBron to do that. He needs to stop deferring. The Cavs need LeBron to score from the inside because it opens everything else up. It opens up lanes for Kyrie. It opens up Kevin Love's inside out game. If he's not driving to the hoop, if he's not being ball dominant, it's just nothing works for the Cavs. And so I was frustrated that he put his foot off the pedal.
Yeah, my biggest frustration from games 1 and 2 was definitely without a doubt the fact that there were 3 days between the 2 games. And I don't think anyone left Northern California at all. That was a little bizarre, but you know, it's the NBA, so I guess they're doing whatever they want to do. You know, have one game on a Thursday and then another game on the Sunday, because we played 7 games in the first round, so who really cares at this point? Let's make it last till August. You know, I'm annoyed with that. But yeah, I mean, I think at the same time, I'm constantly befuddled when LeBron James decides that he wants to go toe-to-toe with the Warriors and beat them at their own game instead of proving to everyone why he's such a dominating force in basketball. And that's why I feel like LeBron's got a bit of a pride element to him that really affects his game sometimes, where he sees Steph Curry run down and shoot a wide-open 3 and decides that for whatever reason, he's got to resort to outside shooting also to prove his dominance. And that's patently false and is horribly detrimental for the Cavaliers because they can't play that way.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I even texted you guys last night after LeBron had it. It was like halfway through his first half, and he was the way he was playing. I said he's going for 45 tonight, and he could have done that. And that's what the Cavs need him to play at that level if they stand any chance in the series, which I think they do. And that's what we're going to get to here. Unless you guys have any other thoughts on games 1 and 2, or Cooper, you just want to flush, do a brain dump. I'm sure you already have.
Yeah, I've tried my best. Just move on.
Do you have like a nightmare last night of Curry putting like the 12-second dribbling clinic on around LeBron and finishing for the layup?
No, but I did have nightmares about officials calling shooting fouls before half court shots, but whatever. It's okay.
Because the same play happened like, I don't know, later. I don't know how much later in the game, and they didn't call it.
Mm-hmm. Same thing happened on Kevin Durant. He didn't get the call.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, for another time, let's talk rest of the series. So what I was going to say, and I'll kind of start the conversation with this, is I went and looked last year at the margin of victory for the Warriors in games 1 and 2, and it was 48 points. And I don't know what the total was this year, but obviously both games last year were blowouts. The Cavs in game 2 last year scored 77 points total, which is just abysmal. And I remember watching that game and thinking exactly what a lot of people woke up this morning thinking, like, the series is over. Like, crown the Warriors. Even the like super team, are the Warriors bad for basketball? And then the series flipped. Is there a chance? I think there is. The Cavs have to make some changes, obviously, but is there a chance the series could flip in the same kind of way? And how do you guys see that happening? Maybe we'll start with John, our objective, fair and balanced voice in the room.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the Warriors have played amazing basketball the first two games. I don't think they've really done anything wrong. Whereas the Cavaliers, I think once again, I mean, they had an issue with turnovers the other night. They had an issue with taking awful shots. And, I mean, these same problems continue to plague them. So yeah, if the Cavaliers were to fix these problems, then I think it's certainly a competitive game. And I would, again, give the edge to LeBron James because I think he's the best player in basketball. I think he can take over games when he wants to, which is what we saw the first time these two teams played in the finals, where he won a game by himself and, you know, kept the other ones close. And again, last year where he, with the help of Kyrie at the end, but certainly pushed his team to win because of how he played and how he took over games. And, you know, if LeBron's ready to do that again, I don't see why he can't win another finals. I don't see why they can't finish it out in six, like I said they would originally, but it's gonna require them playing efficient basketball. It's gonna require, I think, a whole lot less of these half court throws they like these passes they like to do after the Warriors score, and you know they immediately turn the ball over because Andre Iguodala turns around and catches it. You know, it's these dumb plays that I don't understand where they're coming from. That are clearly not working and are actually hurting them significantly because they're giving the Warriors easy points.
Wait, so you're saying it's bad when they throw the ball to Andre Iguodala? You think that breaking news,
yeah,
breaking
yeah.
analysis, it's bad when the Cavs throw the ball to a member of the RT.
Yeah, sorry. I didn't want to go too fast with all this, you know, high tier basketball thought, but all right. Yeah, that would be my analysis.
That was a little mean-spirited. I apologize. Cooper. No.
Because I tend to be about the Cavs, I think it's possible. Sure, like I even think Game 2 was for the taking. There was a sequence in the third quarter where the Cavs missed like three open threes, couldn't put a layup in to save his life, and that's kind of what blew the game wide open. So yeah, I think the Cavs can be in the series. I think there are a couple huge dilemmas facing them. One being the fact that Kevin Durant has equaled the scoring total of Harrison Barnes in 7 games. From last year and done that in 2. So that's a pretty big, this whole like pace comment has come up a lot.
Oh my God. Everywhere
with whether or not the Cavs need to play fast. And I think tend to be the minority opinion that what worked for the Cavs in game 2 was actually kind of playing kind of like they pushed the pace when they slowed down in the third quarter. That's when the Warriors blew them open. When the Cavs were forcing the Warriors to play fast offensively, the Warriors were turning over the ball almost like every other possession. And the Cavs actually had a pretty, I think, outscored them on fast break points in the first half. I think you need to get, you have the two best fast break players on your team in this series, in Kyrie and LeBron. And I think you need to have, like, they need all the opportunity they can to have, get set up in their offense quickly. I don't like this half court setup. I just don't think it's working. And I know the Cavs turned over the ball a lot in game one. But if they can find it, it's almost like kind of rolling the die. I think they need to limit their turnovers while forcing the Warriors to, I don't know, take some risks.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that, but I still think that the pass from the inbounds pass down the floor to the other end is not the play. Like, you have, sure, you have fast players and you can move the ball up the floor quickly, but you don't have to do it in one play. And when they do that, more often than not, they're turning the ball over.
100% agree. And I think we look at pace oftentimes as like an offensive thing. I think you can play with pace on the defensive end too. And that's something that the Cavs did not do in the second half, but did a lot in the first half. They were running all over the court. They were switching high speed. They were forcing the Warriors to play fast offensively, and they need to continue to do that. And they just decided to slow everything down in the third quarter, in the second half, and just force everything into isolation ball. And it just didn't work for them.
I think there's a balance. I would disagree with your assertion that they need to run, because I think as much in the third quarter, it was that they were slowing it down. I think they would push it in situations when they didn't have the numbers or didn't have good shots. And then they get these, the Warriors thrive when there's long rebounds, when there's quick possessions that end when you don't even have your defense set and you can't get guys back. And so I think it has to be selective. Like it was in the first half when LeBron sees himself in a one-on-two or a one-on-one with like Curry or Klay Thompson, and he picks his spots, and same with Kyrie. But what worked for them last year in game seven, and I've said this before, is they slowed the game down the fourth quarter. They have the two best ISO players in the league right now. Maybe Durant is the third, but still, you take your chances being selectively aggressive, but slowing the pace. Because when you talk about, yeah, they need to clean up the turnovers and stuff, that's a byproduct of going fast. And I don't think you're going to eliminate that naturally. And long rebounds and turnovers are how the Warriors kill you. It's absolutely how they kill you. And that's how they killed the Cavs when the games were tight for last night, 2.5 quarters.
The ghost of the playoffs.
I should have mentioned it, but when we started, the Penguins and the Cavs, the Penguins and the Cavs.
The Penguins, if only.
Who would win?
In one sport. I'd take the Penguins in basketball. Be much better than the Warriors. Anyways.
What if the Cavs versus Pens, but both teams have to wear skates, but they're playing basketball. Who wins?
Oh, the Pens.
And it's on ice.
Sidney Crosby is not afraid to break his head open. That's the Pens.
Pens.
So, breaking news. My roommate is a huge Pens fan, and if you could hear that in the background, I'm guessing the Pens just went up 1-0 over the Preds in game four. So anyway, do you guys have anything else to talk about or anything to add about NBA? Or?
Yes, this is a plea, a shout out to Ty Lue. Please play Derek Williams. I still don't get why he's on the bench. Richard Jefferson and Deron Williams are atrocious.
Wait,
can
we talk about JR too? Can we put out like a missing persons for JR Smith?
Yeah, I still have a feeling JR is going to turn around, because JR is just like that. He just decides to play when he wants to. Derek Williams has sat on the bench all postseason. He's like this 26-year-old athletic guy. He's basically LeBron's size, and he's pretty fast too. And Richard Jefferson is atrocious on defense, and I just don't want to see him in the rotation anymore. So Ty Lue, please, 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 please play Derek Williams. I'm begging you.
Was Richard Jefferson the guy we thought was going to get 30 minutes last week?
No, it was Channing Frye, who got in the game last night.
Had an appearance, and then the Cavs quickly figured out it didn't work.
You made it on the floor.
David West dominated him.
Gosh.
Which is saying something. We'll know if Ty Lue listens to the podcast if we see Derek Williams in game three.
We will, because that would be like the weirdest anomaly ever.
That would be awesome. All right, let's move on to some U.S. soccer talk. You guys were the ones that threw this on the agenda. I guess there's a couple big games this week, World Cup qualifiers.
Yes, there are two World Cup qualifiers coming up, and there is a friendly last night, I think, or two nights ago, against Venezuela. And the friendly wasn't all that exciting. I mean, we tied Venezuela. We didn't have our full lineup out there because we have these games coming up that are far more important. But we did get to see Christian Pulisic score another goal, which is always an exciting proposition. So I think we have Trinidad and Tobago on Thursday. And then on Sunday, I believe we play Mexico.
Ooh.
Yeah.
In Mexico City.
A place we've had pretty good success as of late.
Cooper shaking his head.
Yeah, I think if we look it up, we'll see that we won the last game we played in Mexico City.
Okay, one game does not make it like recent success. Mexico City is a tough place to play in. The altitude.
Azteca.
There's a football game there, right?
Was
it the Raiders playing in a football game last year?
Yeah.
You could see the altitude affecting those players in that football game. So I think it's a tough play. It's a tough environment for anyone to play in.
So can we get a quick explainer of where we stand in World Cup qualifiers and what's the significance of these games?
At the moment, we stand fourth in the CONCACAF hexagonal qualifiers. And what we need to do is we need to get up to third to automatically qualify for the World Cup in 2018. We are just now entering the second round. You play everyone through once, and then you play everyone through again. So we're not in a terrible position, but we do need to win these games to improve on our first half performance because it was not great.
I'd be super pumped with a win and a draw. I think beating Trinidad and Tobago is a necessity, and if we get a point out of that match against Mexico, I'll be happy.
Yeah, where is the game against Trinidad and Tobago?
I feel like it's in Texas or California.
Okay, so it's a home game for.
Oh, it is a home game. Yeah, it's at DSG Park.
Which is where, John?
Colorado. Yep, Commerce City, Colorado.
Sweet, Colorado. Love those Colorado home games. Also, in altitude.
But, actually,
for the Mexico City game, which is probably planned. I
think the last time we played in Colorado was the Snow Bowl a couple of years ago. I think it was 3 years ago, where the I think we were playing Honduras,
Costa Rica.
It was not Costa Rica. Too happy about that.
Yeah, they protested and they tried to get FIFA to wipe it out, but they were like, what can we do?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should expect pretty good results from this U.S. team. I actually think the lineup, despite John's comment about a weak lineup, I think the lineup that they put out on against Venezuela in that friendly will be very similar to the lineup we see on Thursday night. It's nice to see Bobby Wood back.
It is.
So I think a win and a draw.
Yeah, I think we have to come away with at least 4 points. Ideally, I think it's more than possible that we come away with six, especially because of the talent that we have on our side versus the talent we have in Mexico. I think we're kind of reaching an inflection point. I think we're reaching an inflection point. Like our defense is a little bit old and a little bit floundery, but I think our midfield and our strikers, certainly we have starters who are good, and then we also have depth behind them that we can throw in at crucial points in the game to get those points we need. So it's probably going to come down to how the back line plays and if we can hold off Mexico's talent to see if we win. But definitely, no question, we have to beat Trinidad and Tobago. If we draw against Mexico, it's a good result, but I think we certainly have the guns to win that game. So.
I just looked up the U.S. roster. How is old man DeMarcus Beasley still on the U.S. national team?
Because he's the only left back the United States has ever produced as a country.
I swear, he's been on the team forever. Okay, anyway, I just made me think of it because you were talking about the defense being shaky, and I imagine he's a big part of that. But, Cooper, your thoughts?
Don't have any more thoughts. I think that's a pretty bold claim to say that we are more talented than Mexico. I don't know if I agree with that.
You can take it to the bank.
We're relying on a lot of young kids in this lineup. Yedlin's going to get the start. Pulisic's going to get the start. Bobby Wood's going to start.
I think Bedoya's starting too, right?
I wouldn't call him young. But I just think, and John Brooks, we're relying on a lot of young kids. Granted, their experience just because they've played a lot because their team's not super talented. Yeah, I'm not expecting 3 points in Mexico City. I'll take my 1 point and walk away with my head held high.
All right, we'll see. We'll do a little bake-off, and we'll see who has the stronger small takes small takes jinx on them, John or Cooper. We'll probably take a loss, and you'll both be wrong.
Yeah, map at all. But just our luck. Like, we're going to get shut out by Georgia in November.
Yep,
or,
exactly.
Or September, whenever it is we play them.
Who is we, John?
Notre Dame. Who is we? Irish.
Okay.
Go Irish.
Fill in the bingo square. All right. Speaking of which, kind of, because I think John's going to talk about this at length in the next segment. This is a new segment that we kind of threw together at the last minute, but pretty excited about it. It's called One Shining Moment. And what we did is we looked at, we picked one sports event, and event is meant to be broad. It's not just a game. It could be a season game, but we imagined it as a movie and cast that movie. So we picked one sporting event, one sports story, turned it into a movie, and picked the cast. So we'll start with Cooper, I guess, since yours is by far the shortest cast.
Is it by far?
Not by far.
I don't know by far, but it is short, comparatively speaking.
Or should we start with John's? I don't know.
Well, John's is going to take like a whole podcast to talk about. I decided in inspiration of Al Pacino being casted as Paterno for the new Penn State movie to stick with the Big Ten and Big Ten football. And so I'm going back to 2002 when Ohio State beat Miami in the national championship and deciding to tell that whole entire story to the state team, which I think was pretty impressive. It was definitely awesome to witness as a fan, as a young kid, seeing my team win the national championship, especially as two touchdown underdogs to a Miami team that I think had won 35 games in a row. And they had only won, like, Ohio State, I think, won their final four games by like a combined 14 points or something like that. Someone can fact check me on that, but I feel pretty good about it. My main characters have to be Jim Tressel, sweater vest, Larry Coker, Mark D'Antonio, who was the defensive coordinator of Ohio State at the time, Craig Krenzel, the Buckeyes, soft-spoken quarterback, and Maurice Clarett was Ohio State's star at the time, freshman running back. First freshman running back to start at Ohio State. And so I decided to play Kevin Spacey as my lead character there. It's Jim Tressel.
I think it's a great pick. Kevin Spacey certainly fits well in a sweater vest and plays the conniving mastermind very well, as we know from House of Cards. My question is there going to be a musical interlude? Because as we all know, Kevin Spacey is quite talented at singing and likes to do that a lot in Love.
So am I making this a musical? A musical sports movie?
No, I'm wondering if there's a moment where he sings. Just, you know.
I feel like maybe like three of my actors could probably pull that off.
I know. That's why I asked. Yeah.
You're Maurice Clarett actor for sure. He could drop a verse.
I think, yeah. You know what? I'm going to go for it. We're going to drop. That has to be like a first ever. Actually, I don't want to know the answer to that. I don't want to know if there are any other sports musicals.
There's one Jeff should know, but we'll come back to that later.
I think I know what you're talking about.
We can't say the name of it on the podcast.
Never mind. I don't think I do know what you're talking about. Oh, I do. I do. The D-Yankees?
The D-Yankees.
The D-word Yankees? Yes.
Yeah. Oh. Okay, anyways, I'll continue on the musical train. And Larry Coker, coach of Miami, John Malkovich, wanted someone who was evil enough to be my nemesis in the movie. And John, you came up with this idea to play Mark D'Antonio.
I did.
And kind of like the supporting actor for Kevin Spacey and Jim Tressel. So Nick Saban will play Mark D'Antonio because they are the most similar coaches in the universe, I think. John, I mean, did you have any other reasoning for that?
Well, I mean, I thought this would be probably really convenient for film scheduling because you won't even have to like really have Nick go anywhere. You could go down to Alabama and film part of it and just have him doing his daily routine. And
That's true. Are there any tax breaks for filming in Alabama? Do we know?
No, but there are tax breaks for filming in Mississippi. So maybe just
all right. So we're gonna go
across the border. Shout
we're
out.
We're gonna go over to Mississippi because I mean, if you can't tell by my cast or anything, we're a pretty low budget film.
In stark contrast to John's film.
which leads into my Craig Krenzel actors. I'm going to have John Krasinski play Craig Krenzel because both their last names starts with KR. No, that's just complete coincidence. I'm going to take buff John Krasinski, though, from 13 Hours, not Office John Krasinski, because that's weird.
But with like the sweetness of Office John Krasinski.
Yeah, he's got to be, yeah.
Soft-spoken, yeah. Kind of the guy next door.
Yeah, Jim Halpert, you know.
Jim Halpert.
Exactly. Maurice Clarett, arguably the star of the film, even though Kevin Spacey's my lead actor, played by Nelly, just because Nelly did such a great job playing running backs in other football films. So just decided to give the nod to him, and he would definitely fit the musical really well.
What's the name of your film? Your
musical? I don't know. I haven't had one yet.
John, I saw you.
But I just totally, I'm like, I think Lin-Manuel Miranda's going to write my score. Music.
A little bit of a sort of a hip hop vibe to it, but then I like
I was thinking like hip hop southern jazz vibe.
Yeah.
To somehow blend all those three.
Mm-hmm. Maybe like Ballad of the Sweater Vest or something.
I don't know.
We'll workshop the name. We'll workshop the name.
That one.
All right. John.
All right.
Your epic film.
My epic film is a drama. It tells the story of a bunch of kids, many of whom face severe questions about, you know, their talent level and, you know, what they're good at, whether they can even succeed in life. And so it's a story about overcoming barriers they face as individuals and then ultimately as a team.
I've never heard this plot in any sports movie ever.
Yeah, I know. It's great. So, like, you know, and of course it's called Thunder Shakers. Because it's about the 2012 Notre Dame run to the national championship. So I decided we need to have a pretty robust cast because it's going to be a bunch of individual stories and a lot of storylines as you know most good dramas are really in depth. So leading off, you need a bad guy in every film. And because this film ends as the team runs out of the tunnel to play the national championship game, some characters won't be appearing in this film.
What a cliffhanger.
Yeah, I know. What a cliffhanger. Freeze frame.
Is there a sequel coming? Do you have a sequel planned?
The sequel's a comedy.
The sequel's this year. go Irish. So instead, the main foil for our main characters is Lane Kiffin, USC. I don't know if everyone remembers, but USC started off that year ranked number one and ended it in a pretty, I think it's like 7-6 or something. So it's these competing paths where we have the rise and the redemption of Notre Dame with the descent of Lane Kiffin and USC into nothing. So Lane Kiffin is played by Woody Harrelson, drunk, of course, you know, because that's how you got to play it in Southern California with Lane Kiffin. Tyler Eifert, Notre Dame star tight end, is played by David Tennant. Doing an American accent because I think that fits Tyler Eifert's country persona really well. Zach Martin, Notre Dame star center, is played by Chris Pratt. Bob Diaco, Notre Dame's youthful defensive coordinator, is played by Zac Efron. Sierra Wood, our running back, is going to be played by Idris Elba, kind of an older, grittier presence on the team. You know, also a British, but he can probably do an English accent. Doesn't matter if he wants to be British; he can be British. Who cares?
I miss Ice-T. What happened to Ice-T?
Yeah, I got rid of Ice-T because I wanted to go with someone with a little more grit and not quite as old. And
you're telling me Ice-T couldn't play a college kid?
I'm telling you Ice-T could play a college kid, but I wanted to go with Idris Elba because I wanted that. I wanted that that Idris Elba's got that scary element to him, you know, like the I'm a large man and I could either help you out a lot or destroy you. And I feel like Ice-T with all his years on Law and Order is a little too tame. So Theo Riddick, who's the backup running back and kind of, you know, plays off of Sierra Wood a lot, is Kenan Thompson. Provides a little bit of that comic relief to the cast, which goes well with Jay Farrow, who plays Everett Golson as Notre Dame's plucky, you know, redshirt freshman quarterback. John Goodman, who not a lot of people remember or even know about, but he was a wide receiver. He caught the touchdown pass that really turned the Michigan State game into a rout, which is a critical part in this movie because that was Manti Te'o's coming out party. Is played by Chris Pine, and then so now we're at the critical roles here. So Manti, Tommy Rees, and Brian Kelly, really the three people that the whole plot kind of focuses around.
You're not leaving like somebody out.
No, I don't think there's any other human being who matters in this story. Brian Kelly, I wanted someone with grit and who can have a hoarse voice and probably turn purple if they need to. And I went with Christian Bale for that one. Matthew McConaughey for Tommy Rees because he's got a lot of depth to his characters and he can play a conflicted underdog who all he wants to do is have people love him, but gets booed every time he steps on the field.
And drives a Lincoln.
Yeah, Tommy totally drives a Lincoln. And then finally, the main role, really the guy who stands in the center of the poster for the movie, Manti Te'o, played by none other than Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Just a great actor. Really speaks to the, Manti Te'o's all-American persona. And
I feel like you're just not tapping into something about this story.
No, I think that's pretty much it. I got all the bases covered.
The romantic interest that could be in the story. The romantic
Every movie needs one.
This is about a team. This is about guys being guys. You know, guys being dudes.
Guys being dudes.
That's what this movie's about. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, there's the whole, other part of Manti Te'o's story. And it doesn't really factor in much because this is, a story about guys being dudes. But I think just for maybe a minute, on a phone after a game, we'll use Melissa McCarthy's voice for something. Yeah.
Why Melissa McCarthy of all people?
She can. I'm really thinking about the sort of the Sean Spicer husky voice she does. If we're gonna go with the realistic situation.
Okay.
Yeah. Because that's
all right. Thunder.
How much of Notre Dame's endowment are you using to fund this film?
Actually, none of it. I think we're just gonna pre-sell every theater seat to the rich alumni. And
hold on, can I re-ask my question? How much of Notre Dame's very large endowment are you using for this?
Yeah, film? None of it. We're gonna pre-sell all the seats to the rich alumni. We'll put in a jumbotron in every theater, and they'll probably all show up.
Every student who's ever graduated is probably going to get an email asking to donate to the Thunder Shakers Memorial fund.
Yeah. We'll see if we can shoot on campus. They're probably going to sue us.
We're probably getting sued for even talking about this.
Yeah.
All right. Let's finish up with mine. I'll do mine kind of quickly. The 2004 Boston Red Sox, which was made into a movie kind of, but Fever Pitch was terrible. So we're going to do it better, and we're going to have David Ortiz, obviously the star, also Kenan Thompson. John and I picked Kenan Thompson for our movies independent of each other. Terry Francona, manager that led the team to break the curse, is played by Larry David, kind of the affable, goofy, hard luck, turns himself around kind of character. Johnny Damon, played by Ashton Kutcher, but Two and a Half Men Ashton Kutcher, where he's got the longer hair.
Okay.
Theo Epstein, played by Matt Damon, because it wouldn't be a Boston movie if Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, or Casey Affleck were in it. So I had to fill the quota. Drunk fan number one, who is seen celebrating outside of the Cask and Flagon after they win the World Series, is played by Mark Wahlberg, because it also wouldn't be a Boston movie if Mark Wahlberg wasn't in it. And then lastly, Kurt Schilling, who is in some light the hero, but in some light less of a hero. You see the trouble behind the man. It's played by Gary Busey.
Is there a part of the movie where Kurt Schilling just yells at his TV and tries to get it to turn on?
All right. I don't have a name for it. But that's coming to theaters in 2019.
You call it the Red Sock.
The Bloody Sock.
Bloody Sock.
All right, let's finish up with a waste of data. John, we'll start with you.
Oh, yeah. So my waste of data is everyone on social media that are acting like it's weird to throw stuff on the ice at hockey games. I don't know. I guess people really don't follow hockey at all and aren't familiar with the Detroit Red Wings and really everything else that happens in hockey, where like you throw your hats on the ice for hat tricks and things like that, and the Red Wings throwing octopi onto the ice. It's something that happens. Like, I get that the catfish looked gross, but everyone needs to get up, catch up with the times and, realize the reality that this is okay. This is stuff that happens. This is hockey.
John, I appreciate you finally going to bat for the Twitter users with me.
No, I'm not going to bat for the Twitter users. I'm attacking the Twitter users.
No, but you're going to bat for the good Twitter users, the ones who don't. I appreciate you.
Yeah, we're not. This isn't getting spun that way. No, we're not. We're not doing that. Cooper, what's up with you?
Yeah,
what's up with me?
It's your waste of data.
Anyways, I've been busy thinking about Lane Kiffin. Actually, in all honesty, I was Google searching Lane Kiffin, and that's a worthwhile Google search, especially because like the first image that comes up if you Google search Lane Kiffin, that's just him, just like, I don't know, very.
Is it?
I'm trying to think of an appropriate word to use here.
Are you sure it's not Daniel Tosh?
Yeah, I'm 1,000% Daniel Tosh. 1,000% sure it's not Daniel Tosh. Anyways, that image search is so interesting. All right, back to Lane Kiffin. Criticizing Lane Kiffin for playing the super long game in college football recruiting and recruiting a recent sixth grader. He offered a quarterback, a 2023 quarterback who just finished sixth grade, which I don't really think I need to go out and say that's ridiculous, because that's just ridiculous. I have nothing else to add to that. That's absurd. It blows my mind.
Wow. How old will we be in 2023?
I don't feel comfortable sharing my age.
Yeah, no, we should do that.
I'll be 28.
I think that means we'll all be 28. But...
And that was math. All right. My waste of data to finish it up is this reporter for, I don't know who, he went nameless, which is probably for the best for him. He asked LeBron after the game last night, LeBron, is this a case where you need to defend home court at this point? And LeBron rightfully replied and goes, well, I mean, are you a smart guy? And the guy goes, I think so, which was a lie. He said, you think so? So we don't defend home court. What happens? He said, yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. And then LeBron kind of dismissed this guy for what he was, which is just, it was an awful question. In a rare case, but I appreciate LeBron's sense of humor. This was, or at least his like attempt at humor. He actually, it's pretty funny him putting this guy in a body bag. So kudos to LeBron.
When do we get our media badge? That's all I want to know.
I don't know. We won't ask questions like that.
I would hope not.
We won't ask questions like that, and we will not ask players, talk about the fourth quarter. Talk about that shot.
No, my questions will be exclusively, how do you feel about the NBA's embracing of hyper-consumerism as a way to sell the game to their fans and the next generation?
All right. And that is this week's episode. Thank you guys for tuning in to another week of All the Small Takes. Hope you enjoyed it. If you did or didn't, you can hit us up on social media and let us know what you thought. Leave us a review on iTunes, subscribe on iTunes, and we'll be back next week, same time, same place.
Dope.